us anyway.
Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna have to get him an alarm clock.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Book Talk, brought to you by MJ Network, MJ in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce. And I am so excited to be talking about Leave No Trace by Jeff Ayres and John Land. Good morning, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm glad. I don't know where John is. I just emailed him with the number. But the Statue of Liberty is the focus of this. Right? And that first scene, oh my God, got me. 1980, June 3rd, a time-delayed bomb detonates in the base of the Statue of Liberty. When I found this, I realized it had something to do with the book that you wrote. And the FBI suspects Croatian nationalists advocating Croatian independence from Yugoslavia and so forth. And I love the Statue of Liberty. So where's my quiz? The first scene was outrageous. And this just proves that children should be listened to, because the brutal terrorist attack occurs, and this kid, Danny, you want to take him home and keep him forever. So what made you decide to do that as the first scene?
Well, it's an interesting story, actually, because an idea of working a conspiracy on national parks and creating sort of an action thriller with national parks, I had been working on that for a while and just not having the oomph that I expected it to have. And so then I went to John for advice. And John's advice to me was, you need to blow up the Statue of Liberty on page one. And I, oh, okay. And then actually in the book it's on page three. But the idea of starting with something big and bold and then going from there.
Well, I couldn't put it down. And John knows what happens when Fran can put something down. She gets eye strain and doesn't care. No, real seriously, I literally probably later will have to call the optometrist for more eye drops, because that's what happens to me. But it was worth it. So why and how did you create this little boy, this kid? If the father would have listened to him, it would have been a whole different picture. So why didn't Danny's father listen to him and understand that what he saw was right and nobody wanted to believe him? You got to learn to believe kids.
Yeah. Honestly, having kids myself who are now adults, I remember there was times when they would say stuff and I'd have to stop and go, wait a minute, I need to listen to what they're saying. And I think in the moment and everything, the dad was more concerned about, you know, oh, I've got the tickets, we got to get up there and, you know, hurry up sort of thing. And, I think it was just the situation they were in. You know, when you go on vacation, you kind of relax and don't pay attention sometimes.
I don't listen to anybody when I'm on vacation. I just hide.
Well, there you go.
And I don't want to know. Well, the only ones that are allowed to bother me are my nieces and nephews. Anyone else doesn't matter, seriously. And this is really interesting, because I'm going to tell my niece to read it. She's taking criminal justice and crime mapping. And she's so smart. So this might interest her, too. So what does he see on his phone? And what happens when there's a huge explosion? And poor Danny.
Well, the kid is he loves boats, and he understands that the boat that he's seeing in the harbor is not the boat he should be seeing, because the Park Service uses different types of boats. And once he figures that out, he knows that something's going on. And then, of course, something is going on. And when I was researching the statue itself, it was pretty neat to learn that they have all of these things in place to protect the people going to the statue as well as protecting the statue itself. For example, if you go to the statue now, you have to go through two sets of security screenings to get on the boat to go to the harbor. And, yeah, I remember the only other time I've had to go through two sets of screenings was another iconic place, which was the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia.
Which that's part of this book also. This is part of this book, too. But I'll never forget it. On September 11th, I was in school. I was waiting to pick up a reading group, and I looked at my nurse called me and said, "You got to see this." She didn't realize it was real. She had no idea that the explosion was real. And I said, "No, that's really happening." And the saddest part is I lost a student that day. One of my students died in the first tower. And I was like, when I found out that, I couldn't even function. But, yeah. So what happens then? There's an
explosion. I
had
family at the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So,
and the Pentagon, too. It's like, and my cousin worked for the Pentagon at that point, too. He was lucky he made it out. So what happens when there's
an uncle were there.
It's scary. It is scary.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's still happening. It's not like it's not happening. So there was a huge explosion. And what happens when he turns around and then there's nobody there?
Well, when the explosion happens, it pretty much goes dark for everybody who's on the site. And that was the idea behind having one of our characters is Gina. She works for the FBI, and she's also an explosive expert. And originally we had two different characters doing that. But when we realized, wait a minute, it made more sense for Gina to sort of fit both roles. That's why Gina became the really great character she is. And then, of course, our other main character is Michael Walker, and he works for the Investigative Services branch of the National Park Service, which is like their FBI. So he has jurisdiction over national park sites and essentially tries to help solve crimes. So the two of them get to work together, and I think their chemistry together and how they play off each other is just makes the book sing.
He has the wrong time on his schedule. I just told him to call in. I don't know John knows I don't do anything at 11 o'clock unless somebody is in a foreign country somewhere. I don't know where. Now,
well, I'm on the West Coast, so it's really early for me.
Oh, God. I wrote 10 on my schedule, and I even emailed him and told him whatever. So Gina is great, and Michael is great. And Gina, you know, Caitlin Strong, you know, John's, you know, my favorite character.
Yes.
Better watch out. She's great. So before, oh, there he is. Okay.
Oh.
Hi.
Here I am. I had the time wrong.
I know. That's why I emailed
you. I'm the one that's supposed to get
say,
the time wrong.
What can I say? I'm not even going to say a word. We're talking about Gina and Michael and Howard. How does Gina assess what happens at the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty? And what I read before, and I know this happened in 1980. It did happen again. So how did she assess what happened at the pedestal? How did she know?
Since you've been talking to Jeff since I was late, I'm guessing you want me to answer that question. And the fact is that she, when you have a book like this, you need characters who have certain levels of expertise. And here, we had a book about bombings, so we needed a demolitions expert. Normally, that would be a third character, a kind of subhero, someone who would show up whenever we needed to provide information, and basically that would be their only role. But in this case, we decided to make that character one of our main characters, and we gave her a background in demolitions to further define her. And I really think we ended up with two bites at the apple, or let me change the metaphor. We had our cake, and we ate it too. in the sense that we were able to kill two birds with one stone. Not only did we give an excuse for our demolitions expert to have a lot of screen time, but she became, Gina became such a richer character because of the background we gave her, not just as part of a Special Forces A-team, the first woman ever to serve mm-hmm. in a Special Forces A-team, but also when you go back and the fact that she fell in love with bombs and explosions when she was a little girl because her father was an excavation expert. That's what he did on job sites. So she becomes a very unique heroine. She's not driven by revenge. She's not, a vigilante. She's not a female Jack Reacher, which is what I always love to call my Caitlin Strong character. She's a professional who has a background that feels a lot more, I think, creative and original than most other heroines.
So are you going to bring her back? Is this a standalone, or are you going to bring her back?
Oh, no. We're bringing her back.
Oh, there is hope in the world for me.
Michael will be coming back as well.
There's double hope for me. You have to understand that this book was great, and it came just when I was going to throw out the other books that I had to review for interviews. That's how bad some of them are. And then this came when I said, well, forget about the rest. I'm just going to do this one first.
Did you open the page and see that it was Jeff and I, that A.J. Landau is a composite of the two of us?
I knew that, and I have your gorgeous pictures in my book right here.
And it was nice. Fran, wasn't it nice to get an ARC again after going a few books where basically you got nothing? You had to print them out in huge print at FedEx in order to read them?
I wouldn't even tell you what they charged me. I wouldn't even tell you. And I stopped going to FedEx. I go to UPS to get things printed out. It's like a quarter of the price. Much better.
Wow.
But this
was
so much better, yeah. So there was an attack, I was telling Jeff before I know, in 1980, that they blew up the pedestal. And that's what got me to say, well, okay, that really happened. And she's the real person. So what does the helicopter explosion have to do with the pedestal and the crew on it? Because there was still another one. And I felt bad about that, too.
What we tried to do is, as much as possible, ground the novel in reality. Of course, you know, the scenario we come up with is big, bold, and over the top in some cases, but grounding it in reality, that's why each chapter opens with a little factoid about where the chapter is set, for example.
Jeff's making a great point, Fran. And
yeah.
I think that's highlighted by the fact that the villain, the primary motivation of the villain, which grew organically through a number of drafts, the way it evolved, he's created by a Ruby Ridge-like incident on land that his family owned that was seized in eminent domain by the Park Service and it was actually for a very good reason, outside of Mount Rainier National Park, near where Jeff lives in Washington State. And that is fact. We didn't make that up. In a Caitlin Strong novel, I would just make something like that up, and nobody would care.
No.
But here we have a higher bar. The other thing I'm realizing, and this is as we're writing the second one. In the first one, in addition to the factoids, in addition to the background of the villain the villain's background that I just sketched out a little bit, we have a Native American kind of a radical environmental group called Fallen Timbers, also based on truth. And even more to the point, even more pressing, in the sequel, and we shouldn't be talking about Cold Burn today, but you know, when I come on your show, I always like to say things I don't tell anybody else. And
that's
in this case, Cold Burn gets very deep into the decades-long conflict between the Park Service and the Tlingit Native American tribe that's been in Alaska for hundreds, for thousands of, over at least 1,000 years, 1,200. So you're getting into real life issues in these books that deal not only with the environment, but also with indigenous peoples, with memorials, with traditions, with history. So that really distinguishes the series, I think, from others in the field.
I read one book like that too. I did with the parks and with the Indians. So that's going to be interesting to see how people react to that. That is doing great.
The reason we pick national parks, among other reasons, is
in this book
each
too.
Park is so unique. They're so unique. You know, whether it's Zion with its absolute beauty, or the Statue of Liberty, which, you know, has the rich history behind it. You can go to the place where the shot heard around the world was and actually see how all that came about. The history and beauty, everything, each park is so unique.
It is. I took a class to the Statue of Liberty. I was really brave, wasn't I? For real. and because they were the best kids in the whole world, they really were brilliant and smart and nice, they let us go up to the top. They didn't let everybody else go up to the top. But it was an experience that once in a lifetime you got to do it, just once. So we have Jeremiah, who's completely off or nut. And what is his rationale for why he chose these sites? And how come all of those sites, and I looked up those sites, I go, oh, my God.
Well, John did mention that the Ruby Ridge-like incident that happened to him, that he blames the Park Service for. And there's some other things which we don't want to get into spoilers, but he basically blames the Park Service for his problems. And so he's going to take care of that.
Well, I wrote a review, and I have to read it over because I don't think I have any spoilers. It's just that I kept writing, and I couldn't stop writing. For real. Doesn't happen. Yeah, I did. I'm going to just send it, and then if it's too long or whatever, just tell them. I don't care. But it was really, I said, I went crazy. And sometimes people understand that. You know, it's so good that people will read it. I get a lot of press on LinkedIn. So if I post a review on LinkedIn, I guarantee in 10 minutes I'm going to have 150 people that read it. That's what's been happening. So
wow.
That does, yeah, forget about Amazon. We don't even deal with that anymore. So when you go to these places, do they warn people even now with the statue to be warned or to be scared and be careful? Or is it safe to take people there?
Oh, it's totally safe to take people there. But like I mentioned before, to go to the statue, you have to go through two sets of security screenings. And that's part of it. And then also... the site itself has wonderful security that you don't really see most of the time. It's totally safe. And it's also beautiful, and I highly recommend doing it. Yeah.
Well, it must be. And
I've been several times.
I was supposed to take a class to where 9/11 was, and, oh, well, what could you do? But what does Walker's father-in-law have to do with this? And what are the threats that are made? What is his role?
Walker's father-in-law is the Secretary of the Interior. And he's a primary antagonist in the book. And it's not too much of a spoiler alert to give away the fact that he is peripherally, if not directly, involved in the major plot. But the interesting thing is, and I know, Fran, that we always talk about the creative process in in these books. Originally, and Jeff will smile as we say this because we started this book, and I don't know if you guys got around to the fact before I called in that this all started when Jeff handed me an outline, and of course I disregarded it entirely because I don't work from outlines. But originally, there were two characters. There was the Secretary of the Interior, who was an antagonist, and there was the background fact that Michael had lost his fellow park ranger wife to a violent incident in Mount Rainier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't remember how it was fairly early in the process for us, because normally we finish the, you know, a lot of the best stuff in this book, the book was already finished in the first draft before we figured stuff out. But in this case, I think, Jeff, it was relatively early on we decided that we would combine the two characters, that the father of Michael's late wife, who bears him a terrible grudge, would also happen to be the Secretary of the Interior, who bears him a terrible grudge, who wants to make his life miserable.
That was
thrillers are driven by conflict. And when the conflict is personal, when it's direct, when it's visceral, it's a father-in-law who hates his son-in-law because he blames him for the death of his daughter. Well, it's made even more fun when you find out the truth about what Michael's father-in-law, the Secretary of the Interior, is involved in, and he gets his just comeuppance at later, you know, if he does. Hopefully, we will see him get what he deserves, and if you know my books at all, you know that he will. And that's the fun. That's the fun that if you – one thing about this book, Fran, and I haven't really put it this way before, and we did this in a one of the other shows that had us on. They asked us if we wanted to do a reading, and the way I do readings is I ask the host to give me your favorite number or his favorite number, and I read that page. Because if I pick the page I'm going to read, of course it's going to be a great page. But if you pick it, then it's random. And they not only did it, they do it once to us, they did it twice. And
oh, God.
I read a page and a half, because the second page they picked was a shorter page. And what you learn, and here's the point I want to get at, there is conflict on every page. It's not always direct and personal as Michael's relationship with his father-in-law, the Secretary of the Interior. But if you open to any page and leave no trace, I will guarantee you that you will be hooked. If you don't know whether to buy the book, do that sample thing on Amazon. I know you didn't. I know you're off Amazon, but you can go on Amazon no matter where you buy the book. You click on Kindle, and you can read a sample. You know what? Don't even read the whole sample. Just page through. Stop at one page and read it. And I will guarantee you, Jeff and I will guarantee you, that you are hooked and you will desperately want to read the rest of the book.
I thought about, see how brilliant your brain is, because I said, you know, what would happen if I just decided to copy a page and put it on my Facebook wall and see what happens? I've done that before.
Go ahead.
But you need permission to do that. Yeah, I do crazy things. You know I do crazy things. But how did you decide on, of all the places, Independence Hall in Philadelphia, or I have the book in front of me, and you know by now that nobody could read this after me because I marked it up and said, oh, my God, I have Mount Rainier. And then it says there's a thing that says add, which means I had to add that to the review. Gateway Arch National Park, St. Louis. How did you decide on which places were going to have a problem and get blown up maybe?
Well, I was going to say we decided on the Statue of Liberty, obviously, because it's such a great opening. And Rainier, the incident of Rainier was because for research for me, I actually got to be a park ranger for a day there and spend some time with the people up there. And so I learned a lot about how the park works. And also for Michael, it just seemed like it was a perfect fit for him and his background. And for Independence Hall, John and I were at dinner with someone who used to work for the Secret Service and was telling some stuff. And we both immediately said, you know, oh, this would be a great scene in Independence Hall. And I'm like, wait, what? So we knew we had to do the scene there.
Well, I love the little definition, the Pennsylvania legislature. I can't steal. Loaned out the famous assembly room for the meeting of the Second Continental Congress, which is when the Declaration of Independence was debated and signed. There's like a little caption to sort of explain the importance of each of the sides. And that's what got me. I said, like, this is really cool. Because most people don't know that. Most people don't know the history about anything.
And most people don't know that a place like that is overseen by the National Park Service. And that was one of the other reasons, too. We wanted to highlight places that people don't necessarily think are seen by the Park Service.
I don't think that people realize the importance of the Park Service.
I agree with you. And hopefully this book will alert people to the importance of the Park Service and what they oversee. And in terms of Independence Hall, if you actually go there and see the room where the people debated the Declaration of Independence and everything, that room is small.
Yes.
I cannot believe how many people were jammed into that small room, really.
I hope they were small people. Yeah, this really got me. Since my niece is doing criminal justice and crime mapping and crime scenes, and guess who's helping her with the research to write it? Yep, you got it. And she gets me at 12 o'clock at midnight. She says, can you do this? I go, it's a good thing I'm up. So where does this leave Gina, and how does she learn how to defuse bombs? How do you know how to do that? I mean, there's a special number. You have to be able to do it in a specific order. Otherwise, you're going to blow up.
Well, as I alluded to before, this has been her love. This has been her passion all her life. Mm. And she actually used it violently for the first time as a teenager, which sets her on the road that she's on. So her training started professionally by watching her father, by observing her father, by as a little girl, draining firecrackers of black powder and building her own explosives. And then because of her expertise, because of her passion, she ends up in the Army where she's trained even further. She takes the next step and becomes a professional demolitions expert, both in defusing bombs and in planting explosives over in Iraq. Initially, she's there as part of the rebuilding of the country. And this is, of course, in 2006, 2007, something like that. But when there's an opportunity, she ends up with the Special Forces, and she finds her job is different. Instead of helping to rebuild the company, she's dealing with insurgents by blowing up bridges and routes of travel. And so it's an entirely different experience for her. And then that has also becomes her ticket into the FBI before she becomes the special agent in charge, the assistant special agent in charge, the ASAC of the largest FBI office in the country. And I think that's important because what Jeff and I wanted to do in this book was create two heroes who were markedly different, who were demonstrably different than the run-of-the-mill thriller heroes that have become almost cliched. The ex-Navy SEAL struggling with his past, you know, dealing with it's like the gunfighter in Westerns coming down for one last fight to save the town. We didn't want to do that. So in Gina, we created the youngest woman and first Latina ever to be to reach this level of FBI management, assistant special agent in charge of the largest office. And in Michael, we created a character who has not only lost his foot, I mean, not only lost his wife in Rainier, but he also lost his foot. So he's the only, to our knowledge, the only disabled hero in thriller fiction today. And that becomes, not only does he have something in his past, as many heroes have, that he needs to overcome. But that thing in his past isn't going away, friend. He's not going to regrow his foot, which means he is going to be constantly aware of his limitations, of the things he can't do as well as before. And whereas most thriller heroes, when they're climbing a mountain, they're not worried about their foot falling off. They don't have that extra layer of character that Michael has. And I think it distinguishes him in a very crowded field, in addition to the fact that, as I'm sure Jeff told you already, the fact that he has such a unique profession as an agent for the investigative services branch of the Park Service.
So what happens with her? Seriously, how do the guys feel about her? I mean, Michael, she's in charge. I know that. And she gets blindsided in the parks. I know that.
Yes.
The course of the forest rangers. That was interesting, too. But how do the men respond to her? Because she is in charge, and she can tell them to go, you know, get rid of them or whatever. She's tough. You don't play with her, which is good.
No, it's true. You definitely don't play with her. And that was one of the other cool things about it. I'm a big fan of the Dick Wolf shows and his show FBI. I realized early on when we were creating Gina that, oh, wait, she's the Jeremy Sisto character from FBI. Like,
mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But one of the things that we didn't know was how would the situation at the Statue of Liberty work if the FBI is there because the Park Service oversees it. And so what we did is we actually found experts to tell us, and mm-hmm. we changed things to make sure it was as accurate as it possibly could be. So, yeah, Gina would be in charge, and she's such a great character. And Michael would be, you know, there to assist. And, yeah, in the future books, who knows, it could be reversed, right?
Well, I don't think you're going to do that because I don't think John will let you because Caitlin will get him. No, seriously.
There you go. There you go.
Well, we know. Now, we have another character. Who is Tom Landry, and what is his role in this thing, the poor guy?
Well, Tom, you're thinking of the football coach, Landry. This is actually Lantry, yeah. And he's only
Lantry,
mentioned
yeah.
by his first name. And, again, you write organically. Jeff and I, in writing this series,
mm-hmm.
we don't write it from the outside looking in. We write it from the inside looking out. And what
mm-hmm.
here's the difference. When you write a book from the inside looking out, you're writing it the same way the reader experiences it. So everything we're experiencing is with the excitement that the reader will have when they read it for the first time. In Lantry's case, organically, we needed there needed to be a subplot. We needed to find out what was in the tankers that were being transported across the country and hidden somewhere that contain what turns out to be a super weapon that can kill millions and millions and millions of Americans. Well, it felt right to have a young character do that, someone who we don't see a lot in
mm-hmm.
thriller fiction. And right away, Jeff, I think it was right from the first time we created him, he became a Native American. Well,
yes.
Quite organically, and Fran, not a lot of people who interview us are going to know this. But
mm-hmm.
as you know, in my past books, another series featuring Blaine McCracken, well,
mm-hmm.
I happen to have a Native American character named Johnny War Eagle, who is absolutely beloved among my 17 thriller fans who read my books. All 17 of them love Johnny War Eagle. That's it, just 17. But anyway... And I know I'm giving something away here, but it's fun because if you're listening to this and you know my past, the other books that I've written, it just seemed like, hey, Jeff, what if we make Lantry Johnny War Eagle's nephew and plant all these Easter eggs along the way
mm-hmm.
of who he might be? So someone picking up the book cold who knows my work, those 17 people, will be able to meet Johnny again. And, of course, that paints a different that puts us in a difficult position because now we've established something, that there will be a cameo in all the A.J. Landau books in this series by a character from another series of mine, kind of poking fun at myself. I can tell you we're going to do it in the new book, but we don't know who the character is yet. And the book is moving so fast. We haven't found an opportunity yet to squeeze him in or squeeze her in.
And I know who
well,
I want
better,
to
because
have.
I intend to read it first. But before I forget, because I'll have a fit if I don't remember, okay, Elizabeth Crowns will be here on Wednesday. And on the 18th, Rise to Rebellion. On the 20th, another Faith Clark mystery. on the 24th. Matthew Cost is a really great author for Pirate Trap. And on the 26th, we have, yeah, that's good, that would help. Oh, the machine murders. This guy invented a book where the machines and technology murders people.
Ooh.
You have to read it to believe it. It's different. So that's what's coming up. And don't forget John Lansing in April. And don't forget Adam Sykes in April, too, coming up. And I'm excited about that, too. And just let me know when this book comes out so I can put you in my schedule. For anybody having a book coming out before August, oh, well, I have my schedule filled. So, Danny, we got to come back to Danny.
Oh.
Danny saves the day, doesn't he? And how did you get him? I mean, they say use his whatever. How does he actually save the day in a sense? Because I was worried about him. Kid is great.
One of the things I'll say about Danny, which I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, is that we finished the draft of the book and we realized we didn't have closure for Danny. And like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make sure we got closure for him. And thank goodness he had his cell phone and was filming. Let's just say that.
And the other thing about Danny that's fun is he brings out a side of Michael that you wouldn't otherwise see. Michael knows what loss is like. Michael has lost his wife. He's lost his foot. And now he finds himself kind of emotionally responsible initially for this boy who's lost everything, lost his entire family. And not only does Michael come to his rescue, come to his aid at the site on Liberty Island of the actual bombing, but I think, Jeff, and I'd like, you know, we haven't really talked about this with a third party, but I think one of the most harrowing action scenes in the book is when Michael, coming to the hospital to speak to Danny and see what else he remembers, realizes that that the boy has been targeted as the only eyewitness, and he has to get him out of the hospital before he's murdered. So that not only is a great action scene, but it's also a wonderful scene of Michael's development. The thing about a thriller, especially a thriller with the pace of this book, this as Jeff probably mentioned already, he calls this Die Hard of the National Parks. And that is so true, because the pace, it's one long scene. It just goes. It starts from page one, and it doesn't stop. So there's no time, Fran, there's no convenient time to show the emotional development or the emotional background and what these characters are feeling. It's easy to see what they're thinking and doing, but not what they're feeling. So Danny gave us an opportunity to explore Michael's character and give him a heart as well as a soul and a brain. 'Cause here's the thing about heroes. If you don't root for them, if you're not, as the reader, given a reason to root for them, the book is going to fail. It doesn't matter how great the idea is. The book will fail because the reader doesn't care. It's very important to any thriller, particularly an action thriller that never lets up, that you care about the people who are at the forefront, who are taking center stage.
Well, I couldn't put this down. I told Jeff before I got terrible eye strain and had to call the eye doctor for new eye drops. No,
I'm
serious.
My God, it's our fault.
That happens all the time. It hasn't happened in a recent whatever, because some of the books give me eye strain just reading the title, and that's not good either. But I'm serious. I can't say what they are, but, yeah, there were a couple of people that got 5 stars, and I didn't give them any stars because I don't post on Amazon, and they were probably lucky that I don't. But at each of these sites, Independence Hall and Lower Manhattan and all of this, I got nervous as each chapter started because I said, oh, God, now what are they going to do to these people? What are they going to do? So we have a few minutes. How did the public react to all of this? How did they feel? Did they support what was happening? Did they understand that they have to be careful? What did the public react to the explosions?
Well, one of the things I want to mention is when I approached John about this idea initially, it was about, it was a love letter to the national parks and the people who work for them. And I wanted to make sure that when we're blowing stuff up and everybody's running around and all the chaos, that we showed the love of the parks and the people who work for them still.
Yeah.
And thankfully, we reached out to the National Park Conservation Association, and they loved what we were doing and totally understood what our vision was. And we actually got to do our book launch at an event with them in Washington, D.C.
You know, you're lucky that you have people to help you, because I asked, I'm writing my magazine. I'm bringing it back. And there were five authors that agreed to write, help me join with heartbreaking and heartfelt stories. And John can almost figure out what mine's going to be about. And I want book reviews and interviews and anything that anybody wants to add to it. And I'm kind of disappointed because I got the five authors, and I guess I'm going to be doing the reviews and the other ones too. So if anybody has a review or an interview that they've done with a book that they want to share, it's going to, the magazine's on Amazon, 414 pre-editions. This will be number 15. And I just felt that it's 14 years since I lost my sister, and I would do this in her memory, but I'm writing it because John knows what I've been going through for 10. So I figured it's about time I wrote it.
And this is still MJ, and this is MJ Magazine, right, Fran?
MJ Magazine, in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce.
Right.
Yeah. She's the reason, well, the truth of the matter is, in 2003, when my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, my sister looked at me and said, "You look like a fat couch potato." I said, "You're going to regret you ever said that." So I wrote "My Name is Bertha" about us, and she wanted to kill me because I wrote the truth. And then in 2009, she said, "Why don't you just go on the radio?" Because she got a big mouth anyway. And that's what it started with. April Robbins gave me an hour on her show once a month. And then after that, I just decided to go off on my own and do this. So it's probably the best thing that ever happened. But I don't weigh 200 pounds. I weigh 102 pounds now. So, yeah. So it's MJ Magazine, in memory of my sister, yeah. And she's, I'm going to dedicate the book to her and to somebody else. So when you see Lady Liberty, when you go to the Statue of Liberty, what goes through your mind when you see it? I mean, she's so beautiful.
My grandmother came across on a boat and saw the statue, and that was her first experience being in the United States. And she went through, you know, the registration service area that was right by the statue. So my Ellis Island. And so for me, it's very personal because my grandmother came, and that was, you know, that was her first experience with America. And I probably wouldn't be around if she didn't come over. So and
my grandmother came through Ellis Island too, because my grandfather went to the Polish underground to get her and her sisters out. So yeah, it's amazing, and I think their names are on the wall somewhere. My grandfather's name is on the wall, but
you know,
it took forever to get here.
When you talk about the Statue of Liberty, to me, I don't. You know, if you've heard me on your show before, people have heard me. You know my politics. I like to call my people ask me my politics. I tell them it's called sanity, and I think part of this book is kind of excising the demons. And Jeff is of the same mind. And when you think about the Statue of Liberty, you think about everything that makes America America. It is the melting pot. My family had the same experience. I'm second generation American on one side, third generation American on the other side. So here it is. Three people on this call have had basically the same experience, right, in their family. And yet one party in this country, 30%, 35%, maybe enough to win an election, doesn't want to let those people in anymore. Those people,
I know.
The people who are destroying the country. I think when you write It is a catharsis. And I believe you mentioned Jeremiah before, and there's also General Archibald Terrell, better known as General Terra,
yeah,
who's the other villain of the book. These people are, they're the ones who topple the Statue of Liberty. They're the ones who want to bring America down as we know it. This is the catharsis in writing this book. But Jeff made a very good point. As soon as I said we have to blow up the Statue of Liberty on page one, which wasn't the original plan when he came to me, he said, I think it was almost the same, literally an organic conversation. He said if we topple it, because it's bronze, you can't blow it up. If we topple it, the book has to end with it standing, being stood back up again. We have to show, and this is Jeff, I'm speaking for him, we've got, and I embrace this 100%, because we have to show that the mentality and the sensibility that this book justifiably vilifies, that turns into villains who are organic to the country today, not just to fiction, but in fact.
Oh, yeah.
They have to lose. They have to lose, because if they win, we lose. And books are meant to be just like great quest stories of old. The hero always wins. He pays a price for his victory or her victory, but he has to triumph over evil. What I find interesting when you think about thrillers is how the nature of evil has evolved. When you think about the World War II thrillers of Len Deighton, Alistair MacLean, you think about the Nazis, and then you think about the Russians in the Cold War. And then you think about after 9/11, you think about Osama bin Laden and all the characters and books that grew out of 9/11. Now, the enemy, I have seen the enemy, and he is me. The enemy isn't coming from outside our shores. The enemy is inside this country.
Oh,
and
yes.
And I think that is what
we
wanted to do with Leave No Trace. What's the worst thing bad guys can do to the United States of America besides kill a lot of people? Or what can they do as they're killing a lot of people? Well, you go after the icons. You go after the symbols that make America great. In the micro of the book, it becomes a plot device. In the macro of the country today, they're trying these people, that 30-35% led by the former guy who was president, they're trying to do figuratively to America, they're trying to do literally to America, I should say, what we do figuratively to America. And I think that's an important theme of the book, and I think that is going to resonate with a lot of the readership.
I agree. It's really sad. The sad part is that they get here. That's the sad part. I watch Air Disasters, and Air Disasters, I love it. It scares you to go on an airplane. There was a plane that blew up because somebody didn't realize when they let this guy through security that he had a bomb, and he put it under somebody else's seat that blew him up. And that's what's scary, that they get here, and we're supposed to have all this security. I wonder how safe it is, how security is at the airport now. I don't even know if it's safe or if they actually, work at making sure that nobody that's not supposed to be there is there. But then people get there anyway. But before we end, talk to me about Danny. What happens to Danny at the end? Are you going to bring him back? Because he's so cool.
We love Danny as well, but what we've talked about is maybe doing a brief reference to him, but since he's not really part of this next story we're telling, we weren't planning to do more than just, like I said, do a sort of past reference to say, how is he doing?
Well, you could probably wait until the third or fourth book when he's old enough to help Gina. You never know.
He'd be helping Mike.
That's an interesting thought. You see that on episodic TV sometimes, where a young character grows into a role. It doesn't happen in books as much, but it is certainly possible with Danny.
You see how my mind is like whatever. So which site of all the ones that you researched, besides the statue, was your favorite? So when people read this, and by the way, Leave No Trace is going to leave my hands tomorrow. My dermatologist found out I read it, and his wife wants it tomorrow.
Oh, my God. Can't she go and buy her own copy?
No, because this way I don't have to wait. If there's about 20 people inside, I get first. They don't make me wait.
Oh, Jeff, you and I have some influence.
Well, Jeff, I was going to say, we got skin in the game. You said dermatologist.
I know, yeah, and I'm bringing him 10 books, so he's going to love me forever. I just bought him. Last month I read 35 books, for real. So his wife has them. And in the last week and a half, I only read 10. Slow week. But we'll see.
Oh, God.
I know, it's scaring me. So where can everybody find out all about you? And, Jeff, I don't know about your other books. What did you write that I don't have, that I didn't get? How come?
Well, I've been mostly writing book reviews for places like the Associated Press and Library Journal. And I did a couple of small press stuff. My first book was actually a reference book for Star Trek novels, which was a blast to do. I read over 550 books and interviewed over 350 people for it.
Oh, God.
And it was a blast to do. So I was definitely living Star Trek there for a while. But this is honestly my first real big fiction novel with a big publisher, and I have John to thank for that.
Did you ever get anybody, because this happened, I won't tell you who it is, last week that said, I don't like your review, could you take it off? Which you don't have to. That made me complete. I wrote the most beautiful review for somebody, and the person said that I had a spoiler, and too soon a spoiler. I didn't. There was one sentence I didn't realize, and I was going to take it out, and the person said that I did a terrible thing, and they canceled the interview.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I was so insulted. And I said to the people that run the tour, I said, I will write it over, but I won't reschedule the interview. What the person did was wrong. It was rude. I said, if you had a problem with it, you know, sometimes you don't realize it. The book was good, but I think my review made it sound better. So, and I posted it, and in 5 minutes on Just Reviews, which is my site, 25 people read it and said, I'm going to buy the book, and then I took the review off. So, did you ever get a review where you wrote something and somebody didn't like it?
Yes. I've had that happen to me. In fact, I had someone attack me at a party once because they didn't like my review.
Yeah, well, yours is good. So, anyway,
now, Jeff,
where can everybody find out about all of
you? You're
talking
about coming at it from the side of the reviewer.
Yeah. And I've been doing this for a lot of years. A lot of years. And I've never had anybody say that before. I try my very best to do wonderful things. And John knows I don't write negative reviews. And if a book is not worth 3.5-4 stars, I just won't post it where you have to put stars. And if it's really bad, I'll just write a summary and not say that I like it or dislike it. Because somebody worked really hard on that book, and they don't deserve to be, you know, treated negatively because they probably paid a fortune to get the book published, as we know. So where can we find out about all of you, and when are you going to do another Caitlin Strong with Gina together?
Well, what an interesting idea. You know, Caitlin's on sabbatical while I improve my name recognition so we can get the sales up again after the death of mass market paperback, where she was a huge success. Mm-hmm. Caitlin, you know, is a victim of circumstances like many characters in the book industry as things come out. But I think that what I found in this business is that every commercial challenge that's forced me to change creatively has made me better. Mm-hmm. If Caitlin Strong was a super successful series, hell, if Blaine McCracken was as successful as it was at the beginning, if that series was as successful, I would still be writing Blaine McCracken. The only reason why I branched out into other series, which I've become far better known for, the Ben Kamal Danielle Barnea series, the Caitlin Strong series, and now the Leave No Trace National Parks thriller series. I didn't do branch out and expand my horizons because I wanted to. I expanded my horizons and became a much better writer because I was forced to. So sometimes necessity is the mother of invention, and we grow because if we don't grow, we fail and we can't do what we love. The point I've learned, and this goes back to my first agent, Tony, the great legendary Tony Mendez, who you would have loved. She was a legend in the field. And she once told me, if you know the characters, you can write anything. And I never forgot that. It's about the best advice I ever got. And I think what I've in through all the ups and downs of my career, and now to be able to look toward, I'm 66 years old. First book in a new series with Jeff is out under A.J. Landau, Leave No Trace. And here it is. I feel like I'm starting over again. I'm 26. My first book was published when I was 26. And here it is again. 40 years later, I'm just as excited about what I do, and maybe even more so. So I have Jeff to thank for that with Leave No Trace. But it's also the fact that if you're a boxer, when you get knocked down, you can stay down, or you can get back up and try to win the match. I've chosen to get back up and try.
I agree with you. Well, my characters are dead. You know that. And Mirror Image is my last book, and it's because of something that happened to me that I decided to take real people that did the wrong thing and told them to look at the mirror and watch your incident, what you did wrong, played over again in the mirror. You have a chance to do it over and do it right, or you wind up as a face in the mirror replaying it forever. I'm serious.
Ooh.
Yeah, I didn't say I know. I got a lot of flack on this one. And then the other half of the book is people that were wrongly accused, people that are whose voices were silenced, and people that deserve whatever I did. So Mirror Image is twofold. But you guys are all on Amazon and everywhere, right?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Thank you so much. This was fun. And just let me know when the next one comes out because I want it first. I have a thing about
we'll see what we can
first.
Do.
Everybody, it's beautiful outside. It's freezing. It's windy, but the sun is shining. Thank you, guys. Have a great day, and bye.
Thanks so much.
Bye, friend.